On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Fresh off the big final blackout of the Sopranos finale, writer and producer Matthew Weiner is on to smokier pastures with his new show, Mad Men. It's a stylish, smart-talking look at the golden days of advertising, the sexist world of Madison Avenue circa 1960, where self-assured ad men brag that they invent reality, even romance.
The reason you haven't felt it is because it doesn't exist. What you call love was invented by guys like me to sell nylons.
Is that right?
Are you sure about it?
Joining me now from Los Angeles is Matthew Weiner, writer and producer for the hit television series The Sopranos. He's now out with his new show, Mad Men, which has begun airing on AMC. The second episode is tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern. Matt, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Good. So give us your best pitch. How do you describe Mad Men?
It's an interesting thing. It's a very hard thing to describe. I mean, basically, what I always tell people is it's a show about an advertising agency in 1960 that, you know, sells cigarettes and political campaigns. But the truth is it's about, I think it's about right now, it's about a kind of sense of what this country is and what our personal lives are like and sort of the relationship that we have with each other as seen through, you know, a business like this.
You say right
it's
now.
It's not a very good description. I'm usually a better salesman about those things. To tell you the truth, I'm so deep in it that now that we're starting our 13th episode, it's become much more complex to describe what it is.
So is that sort of your writing process when you say that's the way it is right now? These things sort of evolve for you, I guess, as a writer in your own mind?
They do evolve. The truth is, you know, I had written the pilot, you know, as I said, 7 years ago, and I always, I've been thinking about it for 7 years, and the characters have been saying things to me, even though the show was not in existence. I've had notes and ideas and thoughts and run across products and had conversations that I've stolen for a long time, and then it sort of coalesces, and then you sort of realize what it is. But what I always wanted to do was to talk about these conflicting desires, first in The American Man. I wrote it when I was 35 years old, and I'd reached a point in my life where I really had almost everything that I wanted, certainly more than I ever dreamed I would have. I had a good job in television, and I was making a good living. I had three children, a lovely wife, and a home, et cetera, and I just sort of got to this point where I said, well, why haven't all these feelings gone away? And I think there's this conflicting drive, which is that you want to be this great husband, great father, provider, head of the PTA, Little League coach. And then there's this other thing where you want to smoke as much, drink as much, and have as much sex as possible. And those things don't coexist, but they don't go away. And I looked at this period and I said, these men were doing all these things at the same time. And, of course, part of that had to do with the pill coming out, and part of it had to do with the environment that they were working in. And when I started looking at the women of the period, I had this amazing experience of reading Sex and the Single Girl by Helen Curley Brown and then The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan in the same week. And then I knew I had a TV show.
So where did the term Mad Men come from?
Mad Men, there was a lot of sort of the advertising industry is like the entertainment industry in the sense that it thinks it's very, very important, and especially to itself. And they have all their own publications, their own clubs, their own awards, and they talk about each other all the time. And one of the one of the ad men used to write these funny poems about the people in different job positions. And he coined this phrase, Mad Men, which had to do with, you know, Madison Avenue workers, you know, the Mad Men of Madison Avenue. And I don't know if anybody ever used it, but I saw that in one of these little poems that he'd written that was in Advertising Age or one of the books. And I was just like, that's an amazing idea. A, that they would think of themselves that way when they're really, you know, writers and artists and so forth and salesmen. And B, that they would hope that would catch on when that was their idea.
So tell us about the men and women of Mad Men. Start out with Don Draper.
Don Draper. Don Draper is the creative director at Sterling Cooper, which is honestly, it's kind of a third tier advertising agency. It has some big clients, but it's not as big as the big people. It's a white shoe sort of place. And Don is a mysterious person. Don has a unique outlook on life and a kind of ability to helicopter away from the creative problems and use himself to solve the advertising issues. But of course, this is based on the fact of what his personality is. And at this point, we don't really know that much about him. We just know that he's sort of straddling two worlds, that he has no problems compartmentalizing his private life. And, you know, he has a wife at home and a, you know, a mistress. And he has an office that's filled with a lot of tension because there's young guys nipping at his heels, and there are the people above him who he may be threatening. He doesn't know yet. So,
well, let's listen to him. Here's Don Draper, sure, played by John Hamm, waxing eloquent on his advertising philosophy. He's speaking to the owners of the Lucky Strike cigarette company, which is now facing government restrictions on its health claims. Draper says the ad limits are merely a new opportunity.
Advertising is based on one thing: happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay.
This period in advertising is so rich, isn't it, Matt? You know, with catchy jingles and the dark side, too, you know, the subliminal advertising and all of that. You've got a lot of material.
Well, you know, subliminal advertising is an interesting thing because no one in advertising will really admit that it existed. And, of course, we have to believe that if it truly worked, that it would be being used right now, and it definitely isn't. So, but as far as what happened, one of the reasons I picked 1960 is that there was what they call a creative revolution in advertising, although some of the ad men themselves sort of laugh at the idea of a revolution or creativity at that moment. But what happened is that Doyle Dane Birnbach came out with this ad in 1959 for Volkswagen that said, "Think small." And it was a tiny picture of the car on a big blank page with this type that we now associate with Volkswagen. And of course, what it was showing a sense of humor and a kind of subversive attitude about advertising, that this is not this all-knowing, all-seeing, or manipulative context that's presenting some idealized sense of yourself. It is actually you. And a lot of that had to do with the introduction and success of Jewish people and Italians, and a kind of more minority subversive attitude. And it came from the beat culture and the art direction from a lot of the counterculture in the 50s. And so once that sort of broke through, what you had was a lot more advertising that was actually making fun of advertising. And some people were threatened by it, and other people got on board with it. But what we see is this modern advertising, this kind of winking, or "I know I'm selling you something," or "Isn't it dumb that we have to stick this in front of your face to get you to buy it?" Or, and all the stuff that happened in between, "That's a spicy meatball," all of this sort of humorous. It's subversive is really what it is. And the idea that the big business machine is coming at you with this very sort of coaxing, "We know it's an ad," was a new thing. Of course, you know, that moment in the pilot, it's kind of interesting because besides this sort of blanket catchphrase that's coming out there about advertising being about happiness, is that the main character is really reaffirming his sense of himself. He was on the verge of failing, and the alternative to what he is selling is this very negative, what's called the death wish, sort of instinct towards selling, which is that it's sort of what Marlboro became. You know, whenever you talk about what is Marlboro country, this, you know, gray haze of a place that has no relationship whatsoever to smoking, or you know, it's a drug delivery system basically. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, we can either tell people it's a dangerous thing that manly men do, or do what Don says, which is say, just ignore that. Sell people something about the good half of themselves. Sell people something about what they want to be. Hmm. Which, as cynical as that all sounds, it's still, to me, part of the American religion of sales, which is you are either selling something to make somebody better or you're selling something to somebody because they're afraid that they can't live without it.
Hmm. Is Mad Men a drama or is it a comedy?
One of the great things about having The Sopranos in existence is that there doesn't have to be an explanation of that to some degree. I don't really, as you can see from the show, genre is a really hard thing for me. I've never been able to figure it out. I never, ever, as I was a sitcom writer for 10 years before I got into The Sopranos, and I really feel like those labels don't apply in some weird way. There's a lot of comedy in it.
Joining us this hour is Matthew Weiner, writer and producer for The Sopranos and the creator of Mad Men. The second episode is airing tonight on AMC at 10 o'clock Eastern. So, Matt, you cut right to it in Mad Men. The racism, the sexism, the anti-Semitism runs rampant. The three martini lunches, I mean, conversations you would absolutely cringe to hear today.
But they still take place, right? Mm. I mean, the idea, I think that the thing that you're getting is a very clear sense of us and them, which is, you know, it's a human nature issue. There is always an us and them. It happens in African-American societies. It happens in Jewish societies. It happens in all of our private worlds. And our manners are better about it. But this is a very clear world where there is an us and there is a them. It is our world, white male world. And what you're getting a chance to hear is a lot of private conversation. And I don't think that it's all done out of hate. And I don't think it's all done out of, you know, a desire to oppress anyone. But it is definitely a worldview that comes from the confidence of saying, I'm white, I'm a man, this is my place, everybody else is a visitor. Mm. And so, you know, of course, part of the story I'm telling is also about assimilation and the sort of education that comes along with those things.
Here's one example of that. Let's play a scene from Mad Men. In this particular scene, a swaggering young advertising man named Pete enters the office of Executive Don Draper, and he begins leering at Draper's new, conservatively dressed secretary, Peggy, played by Elizabeth Moss.
You look like $100. Ready to go sweet talk some retail Jews?
You were tough to take first thing in the morning, Pete.
I've never had any complaints. Speaking of which, who's your little friend here?
She's the new girl.
You always get the new girl. Management gets all the perks. Where are you from, honey?
Miss Deaver's secretarial school.
Top notch. But I meant, where are you from? Are you Amish or something?
No, I'm from Brooklyn.
Well, you're in the city now. Wouldn't be a sin for us to see your legs. If you pull your waist in a little bit, you might look like a woman.
Is that all, Mr. Draper?
Hey, I'm not done here. I'm working my way up.
That'll be all. Peggy, right?
Yes. Oh, and it's time for your 11 o'clock meeting.
1959, circa 1959, 1960.
That's pretty rough stuff, I guess.
A very unusual time, sort of right in the middle of two very different periods in American history. In many ways, a time when America was sort of, losing its innocence, getting into the 60s.
That's the funny thing about it is when you look at the 50s, and you say, I don't know if it's because of who's writing the history or, you know, obviously the assassination of JFK is such a huge watershed mark in the country and in the generation that writes history right now. But and that must have been a loss of innocence. There's no way to take that away from anyone. But if you look at what's going on, especially in 1960, there is nothing innocent about it. The 50s is, you know, Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg had a huge impact on the country, and they are writing at the time when Eisenhower is in the White House. And, Dobie Gillis has this Maynard G. Krebs character, this beatnik. If it's made its way to network TV, you know it's had an impact on the culture. Hmm. And what comes along with that is existentialism, Sartre, and Ban the Bomb, a very anti sort of anti-corporate culture, what I would call slackers. There's just a real sense of a political and social rejection of materialism. And so that's in the midst of all this. And along with that comes sexual freedom. A lot of it is a byproduct of prosperity, which is why I wrote this when I wrote it. I felt it was really what was going on. So at the same time, there's all this conformity going on. there is this seething, you know, kind of life force in the culture that says, ignore all these things. We have to live. Life is the most important thing. And don't think that the baby boom is not related to that also. So, you know, what is the innocence? I know that 1960 in particular, the clothing is very conservative. It's actually the cleavage sort of disappears from Playboy era when Playboy comes out in the late 50s. And then it comes back again after JFK's assassination. So people have this aura of repression, and there is this man in the gray flannel suit. There is all this going, this cultural concept. But in reality, the way people are behaving, it's like someone took the lid off a bottle. It's you know, it's really you know, and of course the pill coming in makes an extra. I've had a chance to talk to a lot of people who came to New York in 1960, especially a lot of women who've seen the show. And besides the fact that they tell me that I got it right, which is very satisfying, is the idea that why were all of these young single women moving to New York in 1960? Well, you know, that's part of that's not innocence. So,
take us through your own history, Matt Weiner. How did you get started in television?
How did I get started in television? Completely by accident. I mean, I wanted to be a writer since I was a little boy, and I wrote poetry in college, and I got into film school, graduate school, which kept my parents quiet for a while.
some stand-up comedy, some acting.
I did some stand-up comedy. I did a lot of acting. And then, I was a performer, certainly. Not a successful performer. I didn't really have the nerves for it. And I also was one of these people who never understood the fact that I was not a leading man. And I would go and get these parts, which now I would look at and say, wow, what a great part. But, you know, you don't want to be that guy. You want to be the guy who gets the girl.
But you had some hard luck, too. You know, you were unemployed for a stretch. And then
I was unemployed.
And your wife supporting you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I graduated. I finished film school and I made a film and nothing happened. And my wife is an architect. It supported me for a good 3.5-4 years. And eventually I was so frustrated. I just made an independent movie, which I'm in and she's in. It was like a $13,000 movie. And it ended up changing my life and in a way that not because of the success of the movie, but because the actual process of making the movie, I was a different person afterwards. And coincidentally, right when I finished the movie, a friend of mine had made a feature called Party Girl. Daisy Mayer had made this movie called Party Girl, which they turned into a TV show. And they were doing this TV show, and she said, "Can you come in and help me with some jokes?" And if you can imagine being on my own for 3 years, writing at home, unemployed, supported by my wife, I wasn't really in a comic sensibility, even though that's obviously where my heart lies.
Yeah.
But I went in there, and I that first night, and I pitched a bunch of jokes. I didn't even know this job existed of people sitting around in a room writing jokes on a TV show. I just assumed it was something different, and literally, I was hired the next day to be on the show.
And the comedy writing continued because she went to work eventually for Becker.
Yes,
as a sort of a day job, and then wrote Mad Men by Night.
Yes,
How long did it take you to write Mad Men?
It's one of those things, you know. How long did it take me to write it? I probably had the idea when I was in high school and researched it for 2 years because those jobs, those comedy writing jobs, are really time consuming. I mean, you work from 10 o'clock, which sounds great, coming in at 10 till 3 a.m, 5 days a week, sometimes on the weekends. And this was always like, you know, like Dick Van Dyke's novel. I was always like thinking about this thing. And finally, I just hired a writer's assistant and I dictated it at night because I couldn't even type. I couldn't even sit up. I just laid on the couch. And it probably, after researching it and thinking about it, the first draft of it probably took 2 weeks. But, you know, it had been fermenting for years.
And did anybody take the script initially?
No, you know, the story is kind of ugly, but it's one of those stories that has such a happy ending that I like to tell it. But what happened is that I gave it to my agents who didn't really read it right away, even though I said, this is the best thing I've ever written. And writers are always talking about how bad they are. No one ever says anything like that. And then when they did finally get a peek at it, they said, "Oh, well, you know, you're a comedy writer and this is funny, but it's not multi-camera sitcom. And we would like to keep the anticipation of what you may do. So we're just going to keep this a secret." And they put it in a drawer. And of course, yeah, it's a great feeling. And, you know, I showed it to a bunch of writers who were always enthusiastic about it. I have an audience, you know, about 14 people who kept saying to me, what are you doing with that show? What are you doing with that show? You got to do that show. And of course, you know, during this, the next 2 years, I lived through Far From Heaven coming. I mean, when I wrote this thing, I thought George Clooney was going to be the lead. He was just left ER, and I was sure that his movie career would not go well. And this is my understanding. I'm much better understanding the past than the future, obviously.
Uh-huh.
And finally, 2 years later, I had left Becker when my contract was up. And I got a job on Andy Richter Controls the Universe, which was a wonderful job with a lot of very funny people. But as it was winding down, I had a manager at this point, and I just said, you know what? There are no more deals out there. Will you send this to David Chase, because they were both at the same agency, and Alan Ball, and this was with the hopes that they would
take it. And The Sopranos.
Of The Sopranos, right. No, I didn't send it just to David and to Alan Ball at Six Feet Under, because they were both writers, and I thought they might be able to take it to HBO for me.
Mm.
And they told me, well, Alan Ball doesn't read anybody but playwrights, which I've since told him, and he was amused by. And David Chase, we send our Law & Order people and our feature people, and my manager basically threatened them that I was going to leave if they didn't get it to him, or at least get it to his agent. And honestly, his agent read it. My agent really pushed my agent was very good about it. And a week later, I was in New York on the show.
Hmm.
And then, of course, you know, I was at The Sopranos for 4.5 years. And, you know, during that time, David was such a huge fan of the show, of the script. And he told me, actually, when I got there, I was hired with a bunch of other people, and people don't last long at The Sopranos. It was kind of a miracle I survived. But he told me at the beginning, he goes, even if I fire you, I'm going to help you with the show. And I think he sent it to HBO right away saying, this is the show that you should do after The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. But it just nothing ever happened with it. So, you know.
And then, the rest is history.
6 years later,
here we are.
AMC came to me, and I was just like, oh, my God, this is my dream.
So let's go to the phones, Matthew.
Sure.
Michelle is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Michelle, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I wanted to – I caught the show last night, and I wondered if Mr. Weiner would comment on – I found it, like, very shocking and refreshing at the same time. You know, how the characters were just so, like, openly misogynist and openly anti-Semitic. You know, I found my wife and I were just, like, looking at each other. Did we really hear that? You know, there's a scene where they have a Jewish client, and the lead man mistakes the boy that they pulled out of the mailroom for, you know, the client, and wonder if... Mr. Winnie would comment on that kind of.
Thanks, you know, Michelle. Thank you.
Yes, Michelle. I mean, you know, it's a climate, and it is very open. I have to say, one of the things about that in particular is I experienced that in real life, and I grew up in Los Angeles in the 80s, and there are some lines in the show that people find shocking. That, you know, when you are a white minority, I don't know if you're Italian, Jewish, Irish. You sometimes are privy to the private conversations. And, you know, Pete Campbell's line, I was a teacher at a girls' school when I was 19 years old during the summers, and I overheard one of the teachers saying, adding money in education doesn't take the rude edge out of people. And I was like, about this Jewish student that they had who was in her face. And, you know, so it is open. I mean, this is the thing that's great about it, is you just don't see it on television.
Well,
and you don't see it behind, you don't see it in the movies of the time, because it's always treated in such a melodramatic way. And, you know, yes.
Here's another clip, Matt, from about what you're speaking of. This scene takes place in a meeting between executives of the advertising firm Sterling & Cooper and Rachel Menken, whose family owns a New York department store. And the firm proposes a conventional coupon campaign with the advertising partner, Roger Sterling, looking on. Don Draper gets into an argument with Rachel and then storms out.
Gentlemen, I really thought you could do better than this. Sterling Cooper has a reputation for being innovative.
Miss, you are way out of line.
Please. Let's not get emotional here. There's no reason we can't talk this out.
Talk about what? This silly idea that people are going to come to some store they've never been to because it's more expensive?
It works for Chanel.
Menken's is not Chanel.
That's a vote of confidence.
What Don's saying is Chanel is a very different kind of place. It's French. It's continental. It's
not just another Jewish department store?
Exactly.
You were right, Roger. This place really runs on charm.
This is ridiculous.
Don.
I'm not going to let a woman talk to me like this. This meeting is over. Good luck, Miss Menken.
Some of that's hard to listen to, you know?
You know, Jane, that was the first, that's the first line that I had in the pilot was, I'm not going to let a woman talk to me like this. And I've heard that in my lifetime. And, you know, it's there's a disappearance of this man. This man is a dinosaur, and he has a code, and he's a virtuous person on some level. But he is very sure of himself and what that world is. And yeah, you know what? It's what I was saying. This is the melting pot. This is the melting pot. And I'm not trying to do the man in the gray flannel suit or patterns or any of these things. I'm not trying to do that kind of. The melodrama that was popular at the time. I'm actually trying to do something about the people who watched those movies.
Everything in Mad Men, Matt, is so authentic, from the sets to the clothing to the wristwatches.
I'm sure we got a lot wrong, but we're really trying,
to
Jane.
The inspection stickers in the front windows of the New York City cabs. I mean, that's a lot
you
of research.
That, huh?
Yes, actually, I did.
Yeah.
A lot of attention to detail.
You know what? Part of it's that I'm a fetishist, and part of it is that when you can do... If you're trying to do reality, this is something that I learned at The Sopranos. If you're trying to do reality, it actually requires more effort than doing glamour. And what I really wanted was to have a sense that we were there. That shot of the fly in the light fixture, I know it has some symbolic context about the man being trapped and so forth, but that was for me to tell people that that ceiling is real. There is no period fly. It is that the fly is not from 1960. There's always a fly in the light fixture. And what I try to do, and what every artist who's working on the show is trying to do, and we try to do it linguistically, we try to do it with every visual aspect of it, you know, that the fruit is too big, I will change the fruit, you know. They didn't have giant apples back then like we have now. I really want the ashtrays to be full. I want to see the wires at the desk. I want to see the clutter. I want to see sweat stains, wrinkles on the clothing. I want people's collars to be slightly askew. It's an idea that it helps transport you into, it helps keep you from having to have an abstract sense of the story. You know, it's like, shoot, you know, I love black and white, and people were saying, oh, you should have shot it in black and white. And I was like, I don't want the abstraction. I want people to look at that office, because we work in offices just like that right now. We live in these homes just like the homes they live in. Our cars are not like that, but I wanted them to feel that they were in it. And the clothing is like that. I have this incredible costume designer, Janie Bryant. You just get a sense that people have a closet. Mm.
So, Matt, I'm going to play a clip from The Sopranos. You were a writer, of course, and EP of that, executive producer of that program. And this is from the fifth season, where Tony Soprano, played by James Gandolfini, and his wife Carmela, played by Edie Falco, meet in a restaurant. Carmela springs the news that she wants to divorce the volatile mafia boss. You were nominated for an Emmy for writing this particular episode. Here it is.
Oh, that's nice. Invite me to a public place so you can ambush me? Well, you think I won't make a scene?
Spare me your outrage, Tony. Accept the fact that I am moving on with my life.
Moving on? That's what you were doing after the party last week?
I think you and I both know that didn't change anything.
Well, first of all, we're Italian. We don't believe in divorce. We believe in the nuclear family.
So do you have fond memories? You must, of your days on that program.
Oh, my God. That scene in particular you picked the right scene, because there's that quote in there where he says you walk around that mansion with your diamond rings like butter wouldn't melt in your mouth. You know, writing for those characters was just an exquisite experience. And working with David Chase, you know, I sat in a room with David Chase and Terrence Winter and, you know, for 4 years, you know, it's just like being on the Yankees, you know.
Everybody wants to know. Inquiring minds want to know about the ending, Matt Weiner.
Well, you know, I don't really talk about that.
Oh, come on.
We have radio silence on that. You know, the truth of it is, this is what I've said, you know, is that it's been like 6 weeks now. And people are still talking about it. So,
well, how is
it
decided?
It did exactly what it was supposed to do.
How was it decided? How did it come about?
You know, it's David. It's David's idea, and he you know, it's what the way he wanted to do it. And it's such a, let's put it this way, David is an amazing entertainer, and that what you got at the end of that show was more entertainment. If you think about the alternatives to that ending, about what could have been shown or how it could have been done, it is so disappointing to imagine those things. whatever those options are, Tony being shot, Tony being arrested, Tony going on vacation, Tony going into the program, Carmela killing him, what all the things I've heard. And you think about what happened there and the mixture of sentimentality, of familial love and dread, and you say, okay, that's where we're going to leave Tony Soprano. It's amazing to me. I could not imagine a better ending.
Were you happy with it?
Oh, my God.
You loved the ending.
I heard about it, you know, like the second week I was working there, I think, or like the second year I was working there. Listen, it's an overused word, but if you talk about that being the greatest show in the history of television, that is the greatest ending for the greatest show. I could not imagine it going any better. And the audience's response to it, that they have a response. The opinions that people have. You know, no one talks about this, but writing on the show all that time, 1 in 20 people that talk to me about the show ever said anything positive about it. People love to criticize it. They had such an investment in it. There was constant, you know, bickering and irritation about the way they were being treated as an audience. And they came back for more because the show was amazing and it made them feel something. So to me, this is just a consistent ending to the relationship that America had with The Sopranos. So it's a success in every aspect to me.
Back to your new series, Mad Men, and then back to the phones for a question
sure.
about that. Deborah calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Deborah, you're on the line. Hello.
Hi. Deborah and I came of age in the late 60s, 70s, and my first job was at Arnold & Company and at the bottom of the heap. And I'm since a creative director at another agency. At any rate, I was cleaning out the files at Arnold & Company, and I found a speech given by Arnold Rosoff, who was the head of Arnold & Company, a really big agency at the time. And the subject of the speech was women in advertising. And I started to read it, and I turned absolutely beet red because his words exactly were, "Women are decoration and they should be sprinkled around the conference room table. Anything they say is totally irrelevant." And I kept the copy. I thought, oh my God.
That's amazing.
Is what it was all about. So your show is dead on. And, you know, I had to fight tooth and nail to get to where I am today. And I think the younger kids who come on board have no clue what it was like for us in the beginning.
Deborah, thank you for your call.
Yes, thank you. It's interesting that you say that, too, because I, you know, without sounding like an old person, I just look at the generation of women coming out of, and you know, and you hear the term post-feminism. I mean, how horrifying is that? And you look at women coming out of college right now, and I'm generalizing here, but I think there's some truth to it, who are getting married immediately. Maybe there's no economic incentive because, you know, everyone has to work so hard. To really get anywhere right now, but they come out of college, they're changing their names, they're getting married immediately, they're having babies immediately, and this sense of I think something's been lost. This battle has been lost in a way for this generation. And if they see the show and see that the limitations of the workplace, it's as simple as this. You go into that workplace and you have a choice. You can either find a husband and get married, or you can become a man. Those are your two options for success. And even becoming a man, you still really, you know, you're going to have to put up with a lot. And, you know, you read Life in Advertising, the Bunny Wells thing, and it's like Helen Gurley Brown's. There's a lot of hilarious stories about, and she's quoting people talking to her, and she seems unaware of the fact. Well, it's like Helen Gurley Brown. I mean, I salute her for the fact these women are writing these stories about sitting on men's laps and while they're you know, promoting their ideas. And meanwhile, they both become very, very successful. It's a manipulation of men on some level that they're preaching because they are getting what they want. But you just say, oh, my God, you know, forget about equal rights amendment or equality or anything. Like, how are you supposed to be a human being and be in that environment and either constantly be sexualized or be marginalized? There are women in advertising at that point. They are not married. And, you know, The Best of Everything is this wonderfully melodramatic movie from 1959 that Rona Jaffe wrote the book about. And in her book, it's very clear that that's what it is. If you get married, that's your window out. That's why you're working the whole time is just to get married. And it's a bummer.
We have a lot of callers wanting
to join us.
Hal is calling from Boston. Hal, you're on the line. Hi.
thank you, and thank you for taking my call, Jay.
Sure.
I hope I'm on point. I'm not in advertisement, but I had a comment about your guest's statement about the privilege of white males not being mean or a bad thing. If that's correct in his mind, I would suggest that for Americans, American white males, that is perhaps their biggest problem, is that they do think that they are superior. There's privilege that's attached to it. There's superiority that's attached to being a white male. The idea that they're better than someone else and no one else matters, to me, is the crux of why we're in the position that we are now in terms of race relations. And both of the series that your guest spoke of, The Sopranos and Mad Men, exemplify the superiority of white men being able to do whatever it is they wish. And I would also suggest our chief executive is perhaps the best example of a white male who feels that they are above all else, and that creates problems for the rest.
Hal, thank you for your call from Boston.
I could not agree with you more, Hal. I agree with you completely. I hope that was my statement was about that those people feel that way. It's not that there's anything good about it. It's horrifying. I think it's exactly what's wrong with this country. I could not agree with you more.
Kay from Southbury, Connecticut is on the line. Kay, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to know how old this gentleman is, because he lived my life. So I want to know how he knows about that, because in those days, to be a female, my first job was, the first thing I was asked is if I had a boyfriend. I mean, not even was I engaged, was I married, but if I had a boyfriend, there was a good likelihood I wasn't going to get that job. Since I had friends who had been through it, I was coached not to say that. But the circumstances of being a female and living those days, I mean, every morning you had to gird yourself just to get up and be able to go out there and come home feeling like a full human being.
Kay, thank you for your call. Matt?
I'm 42, and my answer to that is you have to watch the show tonight because it's what it's about. But also, the truth is, I identify with that concept, not because I'm being attacked sexually ever, but because I think it's in the pilot. There's that conversation between Rachel Menken and Don in the bar, and she says, oh, it must be hard to be a man. And there's this statement in there where he talks about his existential philosophy and how you're born alone and you die alone. And she looks at him and she says, well, I know what it's like to be disconnected and alienated. And I think part of that is what I was saying. Part of it's being Jewish. Part of it is a kind of whatever empathic sense I have of things. I don't question the time travel issue. I really got most of my research is from fiction. When you read the history, you're getting something very polluted. Even when I talked to individuals who told me stories, and I read John Cheever, I read Norman Mailer, I read Rona Jaffe, I read these books, and that's where I got the sense of like, well, this is what it is, and the rest of it's my imagination, and it's such a pleasure for me to hear that it's right, but the truth is, I think it hasn't changed. It's where we are. I identify with that sense of things.
Here's another clip, Matt, from Mad Men. In this scene from the first episode, a veteran secretary named Joan shows the rope to a new secretary, Peggy, who's starting work for this advertising executive, Dom Draper.
Now try not to be overwhelmed by all this technology. It looks complicated, but the men who designed it made it simple enough for a woman to use.
I sure hope so. At lunch, you need to pick up a box of chocolates, a dozen carnations, and some bath salts. I'll explain later.
Thank you, Miss Holloway. You're really wonderful for looking out for me this way.
It's Joan. And listen, don't take this the wrong way, but a girl like you with those darling little ankles, I'd find a way to make them sing.
Matt, what's the process for you, sort of generally speaking, not just on this sitcom, but on this series, but on The Sopranos and beyond, of writing smart television? How do you think about that?
The amazing thing about The Sopranos was just to see this show that was so deep and still entertaining, and that it was good and it intersected with an audience. And what you really try and do is I try and think of myself as the audience and try to write something that does not insult my intelligence, that has gaps in it, that has irony, that leaves things up to your imagination, that is not and, you know, the most important part of it is to try and not follow a formula, to try and tell a story that's based on your subconscious in some way, so that you're leading the audience through a territory that they do not know. And that's really – those are the rules is, you know, if I've seen it on television, I try not to do it.
And who do you have in mind when you're creating a series like this? You know, is a high-end audience in New York or Los Angeles? Or do you think about reaching sort of middle America with your work?
Oh, gosh. You know, you really hope you reach everybody. You know, you want to make an entertaining show. You want people to want to be in that world every week. And some people, you know, I watch The Simpsons with my kids. It's my favorite television show. And I laugh at some things and they laugh at other things, you know, that The Sopranos, and it was not broken down by intellect or income or anything. You know, when the head of the New Republic comes up to you and says, hey, when's Tony going to whack somebody? You're like, wow, that's not that. I thought you'd be more interested in the existential crisis that he's in. But, you know, you can't tell if the audience is being entertained and it's part of something that then you're doing it right. You know, I don't really think that way because you never know, you know, what everyone has a human experience. They have their own lives. And, you know, just that woman talking about going home and being a person and putting yourself back together, that's what I'm interested in. And you will see these rather dramatic events in the office, but you will see the people dealing with them privately, and they are just like us. And when I say us, I mean everyone.
One last call, Matt, before our hour is over. Paul is on the line from Milton, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Paul.
Jane, yes, I'm going to have to sacrifice probably the latter innings of the Red Sox game for it.
I hope it's worth it.
For Matt, it is. It's definitely I saw last week, and I thought I had missed it. Two questions. Is this going to resurrect the career of Vic Damone, singing on the street where you live? Excellent voice, and... I think he's in his late 70s at this point. And I thought it was interesting how you approached involving African-Americans in the plot. I believe it was a waiter in a restaurant who your main character asked if he smoked Camel cigarettes, I believe. You're going to involve that? I suppose it's going to be difficult considering where... the racial standings were at that time to involve African Americans at a participatory level. Has that been a problem for you?
About a minute left, Matt. Thank you, Paul.
Yes, it has been a problem. And actually, you know, one of the things that's great about that scene is that he's actually a busboy. And of course, he's older than everyone else working there. And you get a couple of ideas across, which is this sort of peripheral nature of his thing. But of course, they bond on the fact that women love magazines and are frivolous. They both are sexist. But you know what? African-Americans are a peripheral part of the show. And it's been I'm trying to, without being too political about it, basically show that it's a separate world. And hopefully it's something we can investigate further as the show goes on. But yes, it is difficult. They're not part of it. And every time you get a pool of extras and you're basically saying it to the, you know, for the office and everything, you say to the extras person, you know, everyone has to be white here. In fact, you know, I can't have Hispanic people. I can't have anything. And so I tried to show that there are two worlds because there are. And it's been strange. It's not where I live.
Matthew Weiner is creator of the new television series Mad Men, which depicts the golden age of Madison Avenue in New York City, the advertising world there, circa 1959, 1960. Matt Weiner, thanks so much for being with us.
And thanks, Jane. It was a pleasure.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.